This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A new courtroom is up and running at the Suffolk County Jail Complex. It's for processing people living in the area around Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard who have outstanding warrants, trying to get them off the street and into treatment. WBUR's Deborah Becker is in a session at the Suffolk County Jail and gave us an update about 15 minutes ago during a recess.
We were all here, reporters and others, waiting at 9 o'clock this morning. We just got in. There are three people who were brought here to be processed in this community response court. They've processed one man so far. The Suffolk County District Attorney made a deal and said, we won't arraign this person on new possession charges if this person is allowed to go to treatment. But the person had outstanding cases in West Roxbury District Court. So Boston Municipal Court Judge Paul Tesler said that this gentleman, he would not agree with releasing this gentleman to treatment, and he had to go to the West Roxbury Court to deal with the open cases. So that's one of the three people who've been processed so far, and I think that there are a lot of issues that still need to be worked out.
Deb also caught up with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins earlier, who framed the jailhouse courtroom as a measure of last resort.
I don't believe this is ideal, but this was the only thing that was put on the table, and we have reached a point where we have to do something because I am the one that gets the notifications of unattended death. It's not any of these other people. It's the Boston police that notify me every time somebody dies, and that's a problem.
At the same time, city crews are clearing more tents from the area after giving people living in them 48 hours notice that they needed to leave. They're supposed to be connected to shelter and services. So we called Lyndia Downey. She is the president and executive director of Pine Street Inn, the largest homeless services provider in New England, and a key part of the response at Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard. And I began by asking Lyndia how many beds her shelter has available today.
Honestly, Tiziana, we only have a handful, maybe 8 or 10 beds across the system. And part of the reason for that is that we have less capacity because of COVID. So we're still in a diminished capacity pre-COVID. But when I looked on middle of the weekend, there was 50 to 60 beds open system-wide.
And just to put it in perspective for listeners, Lyndia, you have maybe 8 to 10 beds available. What is the COVID denominator, right? In the realities of COVID, what's your total capacity?
Well, what's happened, Tiziana, is that since COVID, you know, started, we're down system wide probably about a couple hundred beds, even with. You know, we have a hotel that we're still running to help people get housed as quickly as possible. But we're still, you know, still a net reduction system-wide, not just here, of a couple hundred beds.
So that, it does beg the question. The city found in a survey that there are at least 350 people living on the streets and in temporary shelters in the area. If there's, you know, 50 beds system-wide, how is this going to work?
Well, I think that shelter beds aren't the only option for people. And as we know, some people, shelter for some people doesn't work and they don't want shelter right now. I think the state and the city are working on a combination of shelter capacity, some additional capacity out in various sites, including some detox and treatment capacity. And I think the job is to figure out what capacity can the city and the state line up, both from a quantity standpoint and from a timing standpoint?
So let me just ask you quickly, and then I want to dive further into sort of quantity, quality, nature of beds. Do you have any idea if any of the people being cleared from their temporary shelters today may be coming to your remaining capacity at Pine Street?
It's possible. You know, our teams are down there a couple of times a week doing outreach, offering people shelter and or other possibilities. So I do think we will have a handful of people who come in, and that's been our experience so far since the city issued the emergency order. We've had a handful of people come in here. We've gotten a couple of people went to a hotel we're running, and we had, I think, one woman move into permanent housing.
So, you know, you touched on the fact that there are different kinds of beds in this overall city capacity. Some will involve addiction treatment and support. Some will not. Some may be single night, overnight beds. Some might be apartments or more long-term housing. Are they all an acceptable part of this landscape, Lyndia? Or is this the case with what's happening specifically in the area around Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard, that what we really need is, you know, X type of bed, and we just don't have enough of them?
Oh, I think all of the above, frankly. We do have some existing capacity that could work. The state and city are working hard to add more capacity on top of what exists, again, in treatment programs and in some low barrier facilities. Is it enough? Probably not, but I think it's a start. And what I think people need, long-term stability and long-term treatment if they're staying on MassCass. And if they've been down there for any length of time, you know, people are actively using multiple substances. They are not going to, you know, leave a 5-day detox, find housing, get a job, and get on with it, right? They're going to need months, if not years, of treatment, help with housing, and help with housing once people are stable could mean, can I go back to family? Is there a support system out there that I can fall back on? But it's going to be a long road for people, and I think we have to keep that in mind.
Lyndia, there is, for lack of a better word, a coercive element going on here. You get notice. I've seen the piece of paper, pictures of it, you know, on the tent, 48 hours warning. You're offered an alternative, but you can't stay there. There are a lot of people who don't want to go to shelter for a lot of reasons. Maybe they fear losing their belongings or having those stolen. They don't want to be separated from a partner. They're actively using. They're worried they'll go into a bed where they won't get support. Maybe they'll have side effects or relapse without treatment. Maybe they were previously banned. Just first, your reaction to that range of reasons why people don't want to go into shelter.
Yeah, I think those are all legitimate. I do think part of the dilemma here is that we're going to need some of everything, frankly. And for some people, shelter will work, right? It all of the shelters in Boston, all of the large shelters, let me put it that way, are low barrier, which means you don't have to be sober to come in. You can come in under the influence. That's not new in Boston. We've had a tradition of low barrier shelter. And so people can come in. What I think is really difficult is that the type of drugs that we're seeing down on MassCass, you know, obviously a lot of fentanyl, a lot of meth now, those kind of drugs are complicated. They change people's brain chemistry, and you need to use all the time. You need to literally be getting high constantly, and you need a steady supply of needles if you're injecting. And I think that makes it really complicated for, frankly, anything at all, whether it's a detox bed or a shelter bed. And I think we've got to address that head on. I think the question is, we're faced with a whole bunch of choices, none of which are perfect. And we're faced with a system that is not the system we want yet. And so what are the alternatives? And my belief is that we put as many alternatives out there as possible and do the best we can to match those alternatives to where people are. It's not going to be perfect. I'm more concerned about making these alternatives longer term for folks, because the short term nature of, I think, what has been treatment in this country has not been sufficient to really get people stabilized and back on their feet and back to work and things like that. It's a long journey for people.
Could you, Lyndia, or other shelters make some short-term changes to rules? You're talking through a low threshold. I understand that. There are still concerns about people's belongings or being able to be with a partner. Are you looking at making any changes in the short term to encourage more people to come into shelter? Should that be on the table?
I think we're looking at some alternatives. The city has convened a group that started meeting a couple of months ago to really look at how do we think about shelter post-COVID, including how do we rethink some of the policies, some of the physical space, for example. So I think there's a whole slew of things that we want to look at and take on. I think some of this is going to require a different level of thinking. It's going to require physical changes and policy changes. And some of that's going to require some resources, because if you want to have people come and go all night, and people can come all day in shelter, our buildings are now open 24/7 and have been since COVID started. And the city shelter is open 24/7. So people really can come in, and if there's a bed available, they can get a bed anytime. I think what is difficult is, you know, once someone claims a bed, if you're going to leave that bed at 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night, we want to give it to someone else that might be on the wait list for it. And so how do we manage those kind of things? How do we manage the additional, I think, usage on the fentanyl and the meth side? It's very complicated. And the best path is to have as many different options for people as possible.
Now, the other question that is on my mind, Lindy, is so somebody loses a tent, they lose a temporary shelter, they have the alternative to go into a bed or a shelter, they may not really want to be there. And that could raise social, emotional needs, psychological, mental health needs. It could also raise challenges inside the shelter. Do you see that, and how do you address that?
You know, I think we do have, as does the city shelter, we do have a handful of clinicians who work directly in the shelter. They are, you know, skilled at what they do. They've been working with homeless people and people who have had multiple years of trauma and substance abuse, and who also often are duly diagnosed with mental health and substance abuse issues, as well as, honestly, a lot of medical issues, right? And those kind of things make life so challenging for people. So we do have some capacity. I do think long-term, we have to figure out what are the long-term solutions. And shelter absolutely can be a short-term bridge to something else, but it's not meant to be someone's home. And we've got to focus on long-term treatment, low barrier supportive housing, and really working towards recognizing, you know, the dilemma we face with this opioid epidemic, because that's what's driving a lot of the activity down there.
How does it end, Lindia? Ideally and practically, in your mind, what does success look like and how do we get there?
I think in the short term, it is one-on-one intervention with people, with qualified teams that can offer people some alternative and lining up those alternatives now. So if someone says, I want to go to detox today, literally within a half an hour, they're there. And that's how complicated this is, because a lot of these systems do not have full capacity. So it's lining up capacity now so we can deal with the short term, what I would say is a humanitarian crisis. And then I think we have got to keep working on these long-term systemic changes. How do we get long-term, really in-depth treatment for people that deals with everything that's been thrown at them? How do we, again, get more affordable and supportive housing? So I think we've got to work on the immediate and the systemic changes at the same time.
Lindia Downey there, President and Executive Director of the Pine Street Inn. Stay with us. Coming up, we take a final look at the Boston mayoral race on the eve of Election Day. That's what's next. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. One more day. And it does feel like a daily countdown. 5 days, 4 days, one more day now. Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu and Anissa Saibi-George are in the home stretch, each hoping that their final 24-hour sprint will carry them across the finish line as the next mayor of Boston, the first woman mayor of Boston, the first person of color to be mayor of Boston. Now, here with us to talk about the campaign and what they'll be watching most closely tomorrow, two guests that have been following along with us on this for a while now, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks and Boston Globe reporter Megan Irons. Anthony, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure. Nice to be here.
And Megan, thanks to you too.
Great to be here. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Megan. Good to hear you.
So, Anthony, you are out and about today. Just tell us a little bit about what you've been seeing.
Well, I've been sort of trying to catch up with both candidates. So I was with Michelle Wu about an hour ago. She was in Chinatown at the Chinatown Gate, and she sort of held one of her, will probably be more or less her last press conference there before tomorrow's election. And she said Chinatown for her, you know, was a place that meant a lot to her when she said she was a homesick college kid from out of town. And Chinatown was the community that sort of took her in and provided familiar food and people and culture. And so it's always meant a lot to her. So that's where she was. And the message, as you might expect, was despite being ahead in the polls, the only vote that matters is the vote tomorrow. And so she's making a direct appeal to her supporters to get out and vote. Anissa Sibe George, I just spoke with her minutes ago here in Roxbury. She was touring the Horizons for homeless children. She's been on the run for like 24 hours straight. She started at midnight last night and plans to go right through midnight tonight, just hitting all kinds of all parts of the city with a concentration, I would say, in Boston's Black community, which is important to her because her strength is primarily in whiter neighborhoods, more conservative neighborhoods, older neighborhoods. And if she's going to climb this steep hill toward victory, she's got to rally support in other parts of the city. So that's where we're at. And her message, very much the same. It ain't over till it's over. She's working hard until all the votes are counted.
So, Anthony, thanks for that kind of a picture of today. Megan, I'm about to turn to you, but I want to invite listeners into this. Election day in lots of places around the Commonwealth tomorrow, including Boston. Are you voting? What are you showing up for? What's your issue? Why are you going to the polls? And what's most important to you to see happen Wednesday, when the election, whatever it is over? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join this conversation. Reflect with us today. So, Megan, voting is the thing on everyone's minds. And I want to ask a little bit about how much this race in Boston is going to come down to who gets more of their base to turn out. I understand the distance in the polls among likely voters in the last couple of polls between Michelle Wu and Anissa Sibe George. I also know we've heard some concerns about potentially low voter turnout, given how historic this race is. So put that in perspective.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot going on there, Tatiana. The Secretary of State, Galvin, today just said that turnout is expected to be about 135,000 people. That's about 31% of the people who are registered to vote. So it's going to be another low turnout event, which is very surprising given the slate of candidates that we have right now, two historic candidates running for mayor to be the first woman of color. And the enthusiasm isn't as strong across the city. You are seeing, as Anthony was talking about, Michelle Wu in Chinatown and Anissa Sibe George making a 24-hour sprint to the finish line. But there have been also some negative turn in the campaign, one would say, in terms of the super PACs that have been involved in the race thus far. One is paid for by Bostonians for Real Progress, independent expenditure PAC, which supports Anissa Sibe George and is claiming that Wu got a sweetheart deal on her Roslindale home. It's an assertion that has been looked at by The Globe and other news organization and have been found to not be credible, but it is still playing. And the Sibe George supporters are hoping that things of this nature might move people who are on the fence. But Tatiana, I don't think there's going to be a lot of surprises tomorrow. As much as we hope for an exciting race, I think based on the experts that I've talked to anyway, that the polls have shown that the wind is shifting towards Michelle Wu. And unless Anissa Sibe George makes serious headways in those wards, 18, 14, 12, which is, which are in the heart of the Black community, and unless she expands her base, the outcome is going to be very similar to what we saw in the preliminary election. Okay. This race, in as much as it is about the issues, is about organization. It's about your ground game. It's about your connections to the people. And what we've seen thus far is that Michelle has been doing this Michelle Wu has been doing this for a lot longer than Anissa Esabi-George.
So just a couple of notes there. First, Secretary Galvin says he's expecting about 30% voter turnout in Boston. Anthony, I want to pick up on this ad, the super PAC-funded ad that Megan just talked about. And to be fair, Anissa Esabi-George has asked the PACs to stand down. Also, though, this ad runs over the weekend after we see Esabi-George make a similar accusation in a debate since the preliminary election. So kind of pick up on that and what role that outside spending, these campaign ads are playing, especially in these final hours, before election day.
About this super PAC ad, and she said, well, you know, I can't communicate directly with the super PAC, so I really, it's their business and I have to just focus on the issues. And I said, but, you know, you can stand here and talk to me and say you want them to take it down and you don't support it. I mean, you know, what about a public statement? And she said, well, I've made plenty of public statements on that and I'm not going to make any more. You know, in terms of the content of the ad, I mean, this is an issue that she brought up in the debate. And for listeners who don't know what the issue is, I mean, I'll sum it up, and Megan can probably chime in and fill in some holes that I leave. But basically, the thrust of the ad is, so Michelle Wu had a friend from law school. They bought a house in Roslindale together. A few years later, Michelle bought her out. The Boston Globe looked into that. They bought her out at fair market value. This friend's father is a Republican donor, so the super PAC has made much of this fact. But, you know, honestly, it looks to me like a pretty clear and fair real estate transaction that Michelle Wu was involved in. As I said, I think the Globe did some great reporting on this that said that she bought the house back from fair market value. And if the folks who are supporting Esabi-George are trying to make an issue that the father is a Republican donor, well, so what? I'm not really sure that how much traction this ad has, and it doesn't seem like it has a whole lot of substance. That said, there is some, you know, rancor on this final day of campaigning. Michelle Wu said she was really disappointed about it, talked about the kind of divisiveness that we're seeing at the national level, and really made an appeal directly to Esabi-George's campaign to cut it out, that this isn't helping the cause of sort of getting people to engage on the issues. But here we are. This is where we're at. And yeah. Other than that, I agree with everything that Megan said about the dynamics of the race that really seem to be favoring Michelle Wu at this late day. We're talking about four major polls over the last two or three weeks that show her with a sizable advantage.
So 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Do you pay attention to political ads? Do the flyers that come in your mail swing who you're voting for? What's your plan in going to the polls tomorrow? And by that, I mean, what's the issue or the set of issues that are motivating you on this election day? If you think turnout's going to be high in your community, we'd love to hear from you. Again, that's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Megan, I'm thinking a little bit about the city council races. I'm remembering 2 years ago, seems like 700 years ago right now, but I'm remembering the last round of city council races. There was a ton of energy around that race. And here we're really so focused on this historic mayoral race. But is there anything going on in those city council races in Boston that you think has some sway over the overall outcome here?
You know, I don't know if they have a lot of sway in the overall outcome, but they're nonetheless, I think, extremely exciting, at least for me. You're looking at the large council race where there are eight people seeking four slots. The polls have shown that the two incumbents, Michael Flaherty and Julia Mejia, who won, by the way, a couple years ago by just one vote.
One vote.
One vote. And so I, you know, based on the polls, it looks as though those two will go, you know, will be reelected. But there is a dynamic fight right now with four charismatic people running for two of those four seats. They include David Albert, who ran in 2019. He used to be a campaign staffer at City Hall and on Beacon Hill. Erin Murphy also ran in 2019, a former BPS teacher for more than 20 years. There's Carla Montero, a social worker. And the last person is, help me out, Anthony. I can't remember the last person.
Sorry, I can't help you.
Did you say Ruth Z? Did you say Ruth Z? Did I miss it?
Ruth Z. Oh my gosh, how could I forget? I saw her face, but could not say her name out loud. Hope she forgives me, Ruth Z. Lugien. She is a Haitian immigrant and a lawyer who worked on the Elizabeth Warren presidential campaign. These are dynamic, fantastic representatives who decided to step up and jump into this race. And they're bringing a lot of energy, you know, into the race, into the contest, and across the city. And so, but there are only four slots for these, for this particular at large seat. And not just that, you're looking at District 6, which has gone pretty nasty between Kendra Hicks and Mary Tamer, and the race in District 4 is also pretty engaging as well. So across the city, you're seeing a lot more diversity, a lot more energy, and a lot more interest in the folks that are jumping into the race right now and could possibly energize more people to turn up at the polls tomorrow.
So, Anthony, I'm sorry, like five thoughts crashing at once, because I do want to leave a little room, and I will, for us to talk about the transition. But even before the transition, we are talking about a huge group of new people, both in the city council. And while we have two existing city councilors running for mayor, there will be a new person in the mayor's office and a very clear set of issues that have been front of mind in this election. And I'm sort of imagining the pulsing energy of newness coming out of City Hall once this election is over. What do you think the big defining issues over the next 6 months are likely to be coming out of City Hall?
Well, I mean, you sort of have to think about them separately, depending on who wins. I mean, I think the big sort of challenge immediately is it's good to remind listeners here that they have 2 weeks for this transition, which is an extraordinarily compressed time frame.
Yes.
I asked Michelle Wu about that today, and she made the point that, look, if she wins and she's expecting, she's talking about winning, she's familiar with a lot of the faces in City Hall. And as someone who has run four times and won in City Hall before as an at-large candidate, she knows her way around City Hall. So that gives her a bit of a head start. Still, it's a big challenge, because not only does she have to focus, or whoever wins has to focus on putting a new team together, they also have to run the day-to-day. So that's the initial challenge. Then there's the big challenge. I think Michelle Wu and actually Asaibi George talked about it just moments ago, is focusing on the crisis at the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard, so-called Mass and Cass, that crisis of addiction and homelessness. That's going to press on them. And then I think, you know, the reality of turning a sort of aspirational campaign into, you know, the nuts and bolts of everyday governing is going to hit pretty hard. And I'm thinking now of Michelle Wu promising things like free public transportation and rent control. Well, that's going to, involve a lot of negotiation with state legislators, because she doesn't have control over that. I'm thinking about efforts to relocate, for example, reallocate resources from the police department elsewhere. That's going to collide with vested interests in the form of a very powerful police union and their backers.
Yeah.
So we're going to, very quickly, we're going to be introduced to this powerful transition where aspirational campaigning meets the sort of hard rubber of the road of what it means to govern in a city where there are lots of entrenched interests.
And Megan, just jump in.
The new mayor has to pick a new police commissioner, right? Because we saw the controversy that emerged after Dennis White was named by former Mayor Walsh as the police commissioner, and all the stuff that came out about his background and his previous marriage, allegations of domestic violence. And he was summarily dismissed by acting Mayor Kim Janey. whoever becomes the next mayor will have to decide who will lead this department, as well as to come up with all the different reforms that have been promised so far in the campaign trail.
So Wednesday, hopefully we know who the next mayor is, Anthony. What's the order of business on Wednesday? Will anything, I know this is naive, but will anything feel different Wednesday, Anthony? And what's the order of business?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sort of perplexed. Megan put her finger on the issue really well. I mean, it doesn't seem to be a huge amount of excitement across the electorate here, but this is hugely consequential. I mean, we keep stressing this. 200 years of white male mayors is about to give way to, you know, an extraordinary development for the city of Boston, and might I say an overdue development. So I think there'll be on Wednesday a lot of excitement among, you know, folks who supported one of these two candidates, and certainly among people who follow politics like us. You know, and I think there's going to be this moment to exhale and sort of celebrate this transition, this historic transition in Boston. But then, you know, not to repeat what I said, I think the focus is going to shift very, very quickly to governing. And they don't have a lot of time. You know, it's not like electing a president where you have a 3-month interregnum to sort of, you know, go body surfing on Nantucket before you take office or whatever it would be. So that's my feeling, that there's going to be a moment when of kind of a sense of celebration on Wednesday, and then it's going to dissipate pretty quickly, and the new mayor is going to have to get down to business very, very quickly. And I suspect that the crisis at Mass and Cass is going to take up a lot of oxygen. I think Megan's right, the search for a new police commissioner. Michelle Wu was asked about that today. That's going to take up a lot of oxygen. And yeah, there we are.
So, Megan, we have about a minute left. Any other big question that you're really watching over the next 24 hours or even 2 weeks?
Oh, that's a great, great question. I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I will add to what Anthony is saying in terms of some of the big issues that the next mayor will face. And that, I think, is the schools. And as this year two of the pandemic, there's a superintendent that, you know, is controversial depending on what community you are in. And so in addition to the other myriad things that the next mayor must tackle, Mass and Cass, a new police commissioner dealing with the police contracts, and all the other things she must also contend with, how to fix our schools and deal with some of the learning losses and some of the major issues that came about as a result of the pandemic. And it's just going to be a hard trial by fire, one will say, for the next mayor, because there isn't a lot of turnaround time. And so there's going to be a lot of on-the-job learning moving forward.
All right. That is Boston Globe reporter Megan Irons and WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Megan, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Anthony, thanks to you, too.
Always a pleasure, Tiziana.
So we just spent a lot of time talking about that Boston election, but voters in 55 communities across Massachusetts will be taking part in municipal elections tomorrow. A year after record-breaking turnout in the national election, though, interest in the local elections is more subdued, especially outside of Boston. WBUR's Steve Brown has more from one of the many other cities where the polls will be open.
We're just days away from a municipal election here in Union Square in Somerville. For the first time in 18 years, the mayor's office is up for grabs, with the incumbent, Joe Curtatone, stepping down at the end of his term. But looking around, you have very little sense there's an election coming up. There are no campaign signs to be seen, and while some folks may be engaged, others like Stuart Price admittedly haven't been paying much attention.
I more follow the presidential and midterms more closely than the local stuff. If I vote this election, I'll probably vote my party.
all around the state, election officials say enthusiasm for the local races is down considerably from a year ago, when the pitched battle between Donald Trump and Joe Biden drove record numbers of voters to the polls.
I don't really think there'll be a mad rush. I think it'll be a fairly low turnout. I'm predicting roughly about 18%, which is rather low and dismal.
Cynthia Scrivani is the executive director of elections in Brockton, where the incumbent mayor is running for re-election. She says she's disheartened more people aren't getting revved up over this year's contest.
It's very sad when they come out and you get an 80% turnout for a presidential, and you're lucky if you get a 20% turnout in a local election, when your local officials are the officials that you can actually talk to and get changes done in your neighborhood. So it's very disheartening to see that people don't come out to vote for their local officials.
Local elections also draw fewer people in Lynn, where incumbent Mayor Tom McGee is stepping down. Nearly two-thirds of Lynn voters turned out for the 2020 election, but the city's municipal elections usually draw less than half that amount. And this year, just 3% of registered voters have requested vote-by-mail ballots. One reason for the lower turnout is local elections are usually held separately from national and state elections, which have better-known candidates. Local campaigns also don't have as much money to spend, says UMass Amherst political science professor Jesse Rhodes.
There's a lot less ability of candidates at the local level to get people in the field, to remind people about when the elections are going to occur, to try to mobilize voters. And so all of this combines to mean that there's just, when the elections are held off cycle, that people are less likely to be fired up and mobilized and energized about those contests.
Some say another reason for the tepid interest is a lack of local media coverage. The biggest news organizations in the region have focused most of their attention on the race for mayor in Boston, and many local outlets have limited resources, forcing candidates to scramble for attention.
I'm Katiana Ballantyne. I'm running for mayor of Somerville.
Back in Somerville, the candidates have turned to public access television to make their pitches. The chain that owns Somerville's main weekly newspaper closed its Somerville office 5 years ago and reduced its staff. But Kat Powers of the Somerville Media Center says she hopes to raise money to reinvigorate local journalism here. She and Media Center board member Jason Premis have started the Somerville Media Fund.
We know that there is a news desert forming here in Somerville. He and I have come together to form a nonprofit that we are looking to fund journalism that covers the city of Somerville and elections like we're seeing right now.
Powers hopes providing more local news will lead to a more informed electorate and more exciting elections in future years. In the meantime, voters can still do their part. Polls will be open tomorrow from 7 in the morning until 8 at night.
That report from WBUR's Steve Brown. For so many parents, there is relief coming. Children ages 5 to 11 may soon be fully eligible to get vaccinated, process playing out this week. On one hand, this isn't new. We as a state have been vaccinating people on a large scale for close to a year now. But on the other hand, the devil is in the details. Dr. Clovine Campbell is the medical director with Pediatric Associates of Greater Salem and Beverly, which manages thousands of patients. We spoke with her earlier today about how her practice is preparing to inoculate this age group.
We have been planning for some time because we're actually a state vaccine site. We've been vaccinating adults since the state started vaccinating people. And so we vaccinated adults, we vaccinated children from 12 and up, and now we're gearing to vaccinate the younger children, and we're excited about that. It's going to be delivered in a different way because we are not getting the large supply of doses that we had for those larger clinics. So each practice is getting a smaller allotment of the Pfizer doses, about 300 doses. And so that's not going to be sufficient to sustain the big clinics that we usually run on weekends and sometimes during the week.
Sorry. Well, 300 doses, when you've said you have thousands of kids in the practice, how long are those doses expected to last for you? And when might you see more?
I think that the way that we think is going to allow us to deliver doses right now is at well visits. We have a plan to inform families through social media and through email and through the electronic portal that when they are coming in for a well visit, that we would offer them this vaccine. And to accommodate the mandatory observation period of 15 to 30 minutes, we are going to suggest to them that we offer them the vaccine before the doctor or the nurse practitioner sees the child, so that the observation period actually would be while the provider is seeing the patient for their well visit. So the nurse would give the vaccine and then the provider would see them. And then during that time when they're seeing them, that would facilitate the observation period. Admittedly, some families may opt not to do that and to do it at the end because, you know, their child, they don't want their child upset while they're seeing the doctor or the nurse practitioner. But we feel like we're going to offer that option so that we can not take too much time in the office with an upset child, because that's a very challenging age group.
So a couple of follow-up questions that immediately come to mind. First, you know, I'm thinking back to when vaccines became available for adults, and we saw this crush of people who wanted to get vaccinated as soon as possible. I mean, there were Twitter bots that had to be developed just to help people, you know, race to find appointments. What's the response from parents and families about, we won't be scheduling special shot appointments for you, it's just when your child comes in for their previously scheduled well visit?
We're going to put some language out to explain to families that the wonderful thing is, although we're not getting this huge supply where PAGS is doing this giant clinic for these small children, we're hoping that they'll give us a larger supply ultimately. But what they're doing is that they're giving these smaller allotments so that those practices that can't accommodate those large groups of people can also administer the vaccines to their patients. And I think that if multiple practices do this, schools are also going to be offering these clinics for these younger children. Pharmacies are. So you'll have sort of an army of folks who are giving the vaccine so that we can get shots in the arms of these younger children. And I think that over time, we will get to the point where we can administer the doses in a large clinic. But I will admit that it is challenging for that age group, which is 5 to 11 years old. They're not quite as mature and they have much more fear of vaccines. So I feel like giving it in a smaller setting is not a bad idea.
Are most kids terrified of shots?
Some kids are more fearful than others. Most children express some kind of, you know, like annoyance that they have to get a shot, or say, do I have to do this? Or ask, why do I have to do this? Or whimper a little bit. Some of them have severe needle phobia, so they really can't get a vaccine in a large clinic. And sometimes it takes a little TLC. Sometimes we recommend something called the Buzzy that administers like a little bit of a cold pack to the arm or before the shot is given. So we employ different methods to give vaccine to children who are fearful. But that particular age group that is so close to the times when they had multiple vaccines when they were younger, like 4 or younger, that age group tends to be a little bit more challenging to give a shot because they remember the pain.
On balance, the parents that you're speaking with, are they enthusiastic about their children receiving the vaccines? Are they hesitant? Is it really a true blend of both? On balance, what are you hearing?
So it is a true blend of both. It is very different, actually, than the conversations that I had earlier with, are you vaccinated? Tell me your concerns about the vaccine. So the adults have less concerns about themselves and more concerns about their children. However, we have plenty of families who have been texting us and emailing and sending portal messages to say, when are you going to do it? Can you tell us when? We heard the FDA approved it. Are you ready? So I feel like we have a robust group of people who are going to be interested in getting the vaccine and can demonstrate to families who have concerns, you know, over time that it is safe. Because sometimes people just want to observe to see what happens to the first wave of people who get the vaccine, and then they can become believers. And I think that's totally fine, honestly.
What is your message to families who are worried about its safety?
So pediatricians and doctors and health care providers everywhere would not give a vaccine to themselves or their own children if they did not think it was safe. I would never give it to my own two children who I love if I did not think the vaccine was safe. And I gave it to my children the first chance I got.
So I also am struck by the fact that you said earlier you delivered vaccines to adults. If a
yes,
family comes in, it's a well child visit, they decide to get the child vaccinated and the adult isn't vaccinated yet. Do you have the capacity to vaccinate the adult at the same time now? Would you be able to do a twofer if that opportunity presented itself?
Sometimes we're actually able to do that. I worked this past weekend and there was a Pfizer vaccine clinic in our office on the other side of the building going on. And one of the nurses came by to see, is there anyone who would like a Pfizer shot? Because actually they were going to have to throw out vaccine. This is where we are, is that with vaccine hesitancy, you have a situation where you've prepared the vaccine. And if you don't have enough people to get use the full vial of the Pfizer vaccine, you can run into trouble. And we really don't want to waste vaccine. So if there was a situation where a vaccine clinic was going on, we can actually offer it to families. Sometimes they will actually leave the vaccine clinic and come over to see, does anyone want a vaccine? Because we want to give it to anybody. We don't care who it is. If you're eligible, we'll give it to you. And so we don't have the availability. If somebody comes in at 7 a.m. for their well visit, we have the preparation that this family had said, yes, they're going to vaccinate. But I will tell you right now that it's highly unlikely that a parent who wants to vaccinate their 5 to 11-year-old hasn't themselves had the vaccine.
So tell me, I understand privacy. So I'm not asking you to give me specific details, identifying details about a child or a family. But maybe you can use a family that you have in mind to illustrate for us what it means for a family to now have, potentially as soon as the end of this week, the opportunity for a child to be vaccinated.
Well, I can tell you from my own experience with my own children, it's frankly very freeing. People are fearful and they really would just like to have something that might work even a little bit. So I get it because I'm a parent myself and I really feel for families who are just literally waiting on the edge of their seat for this vaccine.
And Dr. Campbell, when that happens, when we have a significant percentage of our kids ages 5 to 11 vaccinated alongside everyone else in the Commonwealth who has been, what becomes possible? What's the change that you're most looking forward to? What's the difference you hope most to see?
So my hope is that we will get to some kind of herd immunity. If we can get to 80% fully vaccinated, 90% fully vaccinated, I am hopeful that we can get to even more normalcy that people can accept. I'm not saying that I absolutely want masks to come off. I think I can live with wearing a mask to big events and being vaccinated. I understand that those two things need to exist, but some people are still very, very fearful and are keeping their children out of being socialized. And I really would just like the nation of children to be able to bring their kids to school and feel comfortable, bring their kids to play groups and feel comfortable, and have their children socialize with friends responsibly and feel comfortable. This is my hope.
And that is Dr. Clovine Campbell, Medical Director with Pediatric Associates of Greater Salem and Beverly. Dr. Campbell, Chloe, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
And listeners, stay tuned. Tomorrow, we will continue talking about kids and vaccines on our regular segment, Ask the Doctors. Give us a call or tweet us your questions for the show tomorrow. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for starting the week with us. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.